Our guest tonight is Jeff Adams, who lives in Newton, Massachusetts, and has made this remarkable film that I saw years ago. The film is called Something's Gotta Be Arranged. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, great. So happy to be here.
So I want to talk more in detail about the film itself, but first, how did you come to make this film? When did you make it, and how did it come about?
Well, I made it as a student at Rhode Island School of Design.
RISD.
RISD in Providence, Rhode Island, where I majored in film and video production. And so the expectation is in your senior year, you create a senior degree project. I tossed around a few ideas early on that year, but I knew Paul Jeremiah extremely well because I had played with him in a very weird situation that I'll explain to you.
Okay, yeah, I want to hear about that.
So I called him and I explained, I'm making this degree project. I want to make a documentary about a musician, and I thought you'd be a great subject. Well, sure, come on down.
Great.
And it just happened.
Okay.
And it worked beautifully because he was so comfortable because he knew me. And it worked out great.
Yeah, that's one of the things that comes across in the film right away is his comfort level doing whatever. Cooking breakfast.
Exactly.
Fixing the alternator.
Right.
Playing gigs.
Yep.
Traveling.
Yeah.
He seems completely comfortable in front of the camera.
Yeah. That's because we knew each other.
So how did you meet Paul Jeremiah?
That's a bit of a long story.
Let's hear it.
I'm going to compress it.
Okay, compress it. We have a compressor on our...
Okay. That won't help with this. One summer, my high school band leader said, you know, you're a tuba and trombone player, but we need a baritone sax player in the stage band, the jazz band, next year. So why don't you take this baritone sax home? So I did, and I learned to play it. During that summer, the clarinet player and myself and the trombone player, who was learning banjo, formed a little trio. And we were busking on the street in Providence, Rhode Island. And so the baritone sax was the bass instrument of the trio.
Uh-huh.
And the banjo was the rhythm and the clarinet. And we all sang sometimes. And it was a great little thing. And also my brother was the program director at a college radio station. WRIU. At University of Rhode Island. Still a great college station.
Great.
They had a Sunday live music radio program, and he arranged for this little trio, which we called the Empire Jazz Bandits. So we played this live show, and I got a call 2 days later. Paul Jeremiah had heard the show.
Okay.
And he liked the band, and he said, well, I want to get together.
So Paul himself calls you?
Paul called me.
Not his agent or something?
No.
Okay.
He said, I want to get together with you guys.
Great.
Because
great.
In addition to doing country blues, he was playing a lot of early jazz tunes, and he had an interest in early jazz and a record collection of a lot of early jazz. He loved that stuff, so he was excited. Hey, these kids are playing this music.
Wow.
So he called me, and he came over to my parents' house where we used to practice, and we played with him, and that blossomed into a little relationship where he got us gigs. So we would go, say, down in Newport where he lived, One Pelham East, and our little jazz trio would do a set. And then he would do his solo set, and then we'd do a set together.
Oh, so that's how you knew him.
I knew him from that situation.
Gotcha. That's part of the reason the film, like the comfort we're getting at. You're a fellow musician.
Exactly.
You've done gigs with him.
I did.
So you have that comfort level.
And we had a lot of fun joking, and I remember one time we're riding in the car, and he said, you know, there's a lot of Groucho Marx in you. That's the ultimate compliment.
I can't think of a higher one.
I know. So we got along great, and we did these gigs.
One of the things that really surprises me in the film is the twist where suddenly we meet Blind John Davis. Yeah, so how did the Blind John Davis connection come about?
Well, it's almost exactly what you see in the film.
Okay.
Is Paul just said, you know, I could call Blind John Davis and maybe I could go and play with him.
Okay.
In Chicago.
Okay.
And I said, well, that sounds great. And that would make a good finale to the film to see you guys playing together.
It does. It does.
And so it just made sense. This is going to be the payoff at the end. After you've seen Paul perform solo and talk about his life a little bit.
Yeah.
That he's going to perform with one of the old guys.
Yeah.
And the ultimate message being, you know, I'm the new generation and they're passing on the blues to us and we're going to pass it on to somebody else. So it just made sense.
Wow.
And so he drove to Chicago because he gigged, drove his car.
The car all over the country. The Dodge Dart.
The Dodge Dart. He drove all over the country, had gigs everywhere in the Midwest and everywhere. And he had a gig in Chicago. And at the time, I was still a student at Rhode Island School of Design in my senior year, but I had a part-time job that had been a summer job, and it was at a medical company, and I was shooting video for this company. There was some conference or something going on, or surgery I had to shoot or something, and it was in the Midwest, and I convinced the company to also fly me to Chicago.
You make your way to Chicago. Luckily, blind John Davis is still there and still alive. He died in 1985, two years later, that was shot.
Yeah,
he was born in 1913. And for people who don't know, blind John Davis was part of this pre-Muddy Waters Chicago-era blues where he played a lot with Tampa Red and Big Bill Brunzi and the first Sonny Boy Williamson. A lot of these guys were on the Bluebird label.
Did you mention that he played the piano?
Yeah, oh, I forgot. We didn't say that, did we? Hopefully you'll see the film. He's a phenomenal piano player and has some great boogie-woogie pieces under his own name.
Oh, yeah.
And then, yeah, phenomenal piano player. And it is a touching moment where he is, where he and Paul are kind of talking, and John Davis is talking about what the blues is to him, and how whether or not white people, how they fit into it or not, I think is really interesting. And Paul's right there. And they do one of my favorite songs, Don't You Lie to Me. I love that song. I think of it as a Tampa Red song. A couple other film details I want to talk about. I'm way interested in film and blues, so this hits a perfect intersection for me.
Great.
The shot of the toast that he throws out is also a great shot. He's apparently kind of chronically burning the toast, I kind of gather. Was that?
Well, he's making his breakfast.
Yeah.
And he's talking to me while I'm filming him make breakfast, and he's telling me anecdotes. And while he's doing that, he had put the toast in, and then he realizes the toast is burning.
Yeah, right, right.
And he throws it outside.
Yeah, yeah. But then you grab a quick shot of
the toast. Yeah, you see it laying on the ground. You have to see that.
Yeah, to finish the narrative arc of him throwing the toast out.
It doesn't matter now because you won't see it, but when I edited the film, it was on film. You have to chop up the...
Cut it
together, make an A roll and a B roll, and it gets sent to the printer.
Ah.
And I did that, and you're using cement and a splicer to put bits of 60mm film together.
Wow.
And I put the toast shot upside down.
Oh, really?
And I couldn't tell working on a light table because there was no perspective in the shot.
Right, there's
I couldn't tell, like a telephone pole
we could see or something.
Yeah, there's nothing indicating because you're looking straight down at the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
But then when you see the film projected, oh no.
Oh.
That's upside down because you can see the toast, the perspective is not quite right.
Oh, I'll have to look closely at that.
Not anymore. I fixed it.
Oh, you fixed it.
Yeah, so when we got into the digital age, and I got a new transfer of the film done to make the DVD.
You sent me a DVD.
Right, you have that DVD.
Yeah, I love that.
And then that's the transfer that the YouTube video is made from. I flipped it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
To finally fix that mistake.
One thing I saw, Paul, when I glimpsed Paul in the one of the performance segments, I think he's playing at the Last Call Saloon.
That's correct.
And that is a place I used to play. The brief time I lived in Providence,
that's right.
I was immersed in this blues scene. That's when I saw Paul a couple times.
Yep.
So, but you were playing music as well in the Providence scene. What did you play and who'd you play with
at that time? When I was at RISD, I met Gail Greenwood. We were in a band together called The Dames.
The Dames.
We won the WBRU Rock Hunt in 1986.
Okay.
And then, as happened with every other Rock Hunt winner, we broke up shortly thereafter.
It's almost written into the script, I think.
And it was an all-girl band with two guys in it.
Nice.
And I played tenor, mostly.
Okay.
Tenor sax. And so I got to know Gail, and she helped me on the film.
Oh, she did. How did she help?
She was a student at RISD.
Oh.
And she was an assistant. She took me places. She drove me places.
Okay.
She lugged equipment around.
Great.
She was terrific.
Fantastic.
And is still terrific. So we had this band, The Dames, for about 5 years or so. And then there's a wonderful arts organization in Providence called AS220.
Right, which had a performance space.
Performance space now. They own four buildings. It's a beautiful thing. And so I hooked up with musicians there, and there was a group called the Smokin' Jackets, a little blues band.
Ah, nice.
With a Professor Longhair-style pianist.
Oh, nice.
I played saxophone with them for a while. And then there was a house funk band at AS220 called the Neo-90s Dance Band.
Cool.
And I was in the horn section for that.
Cool.
And
you're still playing today.
Yeah, now I'm playing in an activist street brass band that's based in Somerville, Massachusetts, called the Second Line Social Aid and Pleasure Society Brass Band.
Great name.
And that band started the Honk Festival in Somerville in 2006.
Which is a nationally known...
It's grown into a movement.
Big thing,
it's
yeah.
A honk.
Honk,
it's
yeah.
Honk West, Honk Texas.
Ah!
There's Pronk in Providence.
Okay, great.
There's Bronk in Brooklyn.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, cool.
And other festivals around the world where these activist street bands get together and make noise.
Yeah, we have...
So I do that.
Yeah, we have... In Bloomington, we have the Jefferson Street Parade,
yeah,
which kind of touches on that a little bit.
Yeah.
It's exciting for me to see music performed... publicly and on the street, and it's something that people did before recorded music.
And it's made,
on the street.
It's made band instruments cool with kids.
Yeah, that's true.
More importantly,
that's true.
You know, everybody,
right.
When I was a kid, they wanted to play guitar like
you. Play guitar.
And nobody
right.
played saxophone and trumpet.
Right. Yeah. But now it's cool.
Now it's cool to play trombone, especially.
Yeah.
You know, wind instruments are suddenly very cool.
Yes.
It's a good thing.
That is a good thing. Have you checked in with Paul in the last, this was 35 years ago.
Yeah, I didn't see Paul much after I made the film,
uh-huh.
because I got on with
life. Yeah, you were moving on, yeah.
He was, his lifestyle that you see depicted in the film, he gets in his car, he goes all around the country doing these gigs.
Yeah.
He hauls his own sound gear. So I was out of touch with him, and then in the DVD era,
uh-huh.
I decided I should, and I guess I was coming up on an anniversary of the film.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it would be great if Paul on his gigs, he had DVDs of this film that he could sell.
Oh, that's a great idea.
In addition to his CDs.
Yeah, right.
So that motivated me to make do a new transfer from film.
Uh-huh.
And correct that toast shot.
Okay, right.
And,
flip that over. Yeah.
Make a DVD. And you had recommended that Blues Archive.
Right, in Mississippi.
Mississippi. So that was another thing.
University of Mississippi Blues Archive.
I did that.
Perfect thing. Oh, wonderful.
That's exactly what you recommended.
Great, wonderful.
So I made the DVD and got in touch with Paul.
Oh, great.
And we met at Zip's Diner in Connecticut. Perfect
okay.
Paul place to meet.
Great.
And this might have been about 10 years ago.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Something like that. And he was the same old Paul.
Same as in the film.
Same as in the film. We had a great time laughing and sitting
great.
There. And then he said, why don't you come over to my house and we'll listen to some records.
Great.
So we did. Went to his house and he was renting a space in a house in southern Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
And I looked around and I thought, this is amazing. It's exactly the same.
Wow.
He's playing music on the road, playing country blues. He's got his record collection in his little house. Nothing had changed.
Wow.
But, I mean, in a beautiful way. You know, we get so obsessed with forward motion in
yes.
our careers. And
yes.
I got to
yep.
do this. I got to sell
thing,
that and get
thing.
One of those. And then I got to move up to that level. And I got to advance to this level.
Yeah.
Paul, he was still doing the same thing so beautifully.
Wow, that's great.
It blew me away.
That's great.
So if you see the film, it's not much different from what Paul was doing 25 years later.
Wow.
He was just 25 years older.
Wow. That's great.
So he was doing great.
That's great. A couple
and
of years
then,
ago... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, maybe this is what you're going to say.
Well, a couple of years ago, Roy Bookbinder, who is a friend of Paul's, came to Bloomington, and I mentioned the film to him. That was before it was on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And he was definitely familiar with the film and echoed the same thing you're describing, that Paul basically is kind of like, he said, well, you saw the film, that's kind of what Paul's doing now. You know, and this was only a couple years ago, so, yeah.
Well, sadly, in 2014, he suffered a stroke.
Yeah, I heard about that, and I looked up, and he was inducted into the Rhode Island Music Hall of Fame around that same time, so
yeah.
I'm really glad he got that recognition, which is great.
Yeah, I saw him 2 years ago.
You did? Okay.
Yep, he's living with a good friend of his in Providence.
Great.
And she's terrific, and she's taking care of him, and she, it's very important to her and to Paul to have musicians dropping in to play with him.
Oh, great.
And so
great.
A couple of years ago, I started messing around with ukulele and then tenor guitar. So I brought my tenor guitar down there.
Ah, he must have been intrigued.
And he and I, he liked seeing that.
Yeah.
And when we had this little arrangement, our banjo player doubled. He had a tenor guitar that he would switch between banjo and guitar.
Uh-huh.
So Paul was familiar with it from those days. So I went down and strummed a few chords with him. and it was a lot of fun.
Cool, that's great.
Yeah, I haven't been down since.
Oh, that's great. You could see him so recently.
See him
that's
again.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that was 2016, I think. I saw.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
As a bit of a diversion, why has Providence, Rhode Island, been such a great music scene? I once saw a picture of T-Bone Walker, you know, the great Texas electric guitar player, playing at some place in Providence. But what's your why Providence?
I don't have an explanation except that it just is.
Uh-huh.
And that there's a kind of, for a while, there was a kinship between Providence and Austin because of the band Roomful of Blues.
Yes.
And
the Fabulous Thunderbirds. Yes. And because Duke and the Preston Hubbard.
Preston Hubbard, right.
Yes. And Fran Christina.
Exactly.
Who was with Asleep at the Wheel and the T-Birds.
Right. Yeah, there was like a pipeline.
Yeah.
Between Providence and Austin.
That was always my impression.
Yeah. So I think that contributed to it.
Okay.
And I have no other explanation other than that. There were always good bands in Providence, like Roomful of Blues.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to mention about this film and, you know, having it out there in the world for 35 years?
I'm so thrilled people are seeing it because it sat on a shelf. I entered it in a couple of festivals locally, but then there was no place for it to go. I was just at this film conference here at IU.
Right.
And someone mentioned, you know, you spend all this time, you make a film, you're done with the film, but you're only half done. Because now you got to put it somewhere.
You got to
promote it. It's got to go places.
Yeah.
So it's a whole new job.
Mm.
When you're an independent person just making your own work, making the work is half the job. Now you got to do something with it.
Right.
So I didn't. But when YouTube came along, it's great.
It's a great fit for
you. You get it out there.
Yeah.
And it's out there. People see it. They comment on it.
And the comments on it are wonderful. People, the comments about Paul and about the film, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful It's a way in which the YouTube age is kind of a positive thing to have people to see this film that otherwise wouldn't see it.
Right.
And to kind of comment and participate in their own way. I think it's wonderful.
Someone did say, you know, you should have filmed some more with Paul, like an update, like where is he now?
Oh, okay.
But as Roy Bookbinder has pointed out, there's no need.
That's kind of...
What you see in the film is the lifestyle that Paul has led since then.
Wow.
You know, different cars.
Yeah.
Different tunes.
Different Dodges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Different.
Yeah, he has 11
places.
More albums out now.
Yeah, that's more. He's got 10 or 12 records out.
Yeah.
And he's living that same lifestyle.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing.
Thank you for coming in and being a part of WFHB. We always want to know, like, what are people... Bloomington's a wonderful place. What's your connection to Bloomington?
Well, my wife's father was an Indiana University professor for many, many years in mathematics and then computer science and then informatics. So I visited Bloomington.
Oh, so you were...
Starting when I got married in 1992, twice a year. We're here in the winter and the summer.
Great.
And I love Bloomington.
It's a great town.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of music and...
There's a lot of espresso.
A lot of espresso, exactly. Last question. What are you going to do next? What's next in your either... any intersection of film or music or film?
Well, there's a wonderful drummer in New Orleans. He's the king of Treme, Shannon Powell. I've heard him interviewed on NPR.
Okay.
He's a very smart and very funny man and a fabulous drummer.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a fantasy project. Like,
great.
To go down in New Orleans. Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be cool.
To make a film about Shannon Powell.
That would be really cool.
Because he's also at an intersection. Mm. He touches on all kinds of music. And when I heard him on NPR, just for a few minutes, he so beautifully explained the basic rhythm that powers New Orleans and rock and roll music. And
wow.
I can't reproduce that.
Wow.
You have to go find that.
Okay, we'll look
listen
for that.
To that.
Okay.
But if you listen to it, you'll say to yourself, I want to make a film about him because he's a smart and funny and talented man.
A great subject.
So that's something in the back of my head I'd love to do.
One. Thank you so much. It's been fabulous. Jeff Adams.
Thank you so much.
The filmmaker of the 35th anniversary. Came out in 1983. Widely available on YouTube. Easily available on YouTube now.
Easily available.
Starring Paul Jeremiah and Blind John Davis. Something Gotta Be Arranged. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. I should make a film about you.
Yeah.